family, ladies and gentlemen. In California, a little north of Berkeley, there are some small miscellaneous farms. On one of these farms, the man and his wife raised a few chickens and a few sheep, a few cows and a few goats. One day, a lady who had been downtown shopping came home and glanced over the field as usual. She came into the house. She said to her husband, I don't see our old billy goat out in the pasture. Has anything happened to him? He said, well, Mama, while you were gone, some of those students there at Berkeley came driving by, and they saw him, and they offered me $100 for him, and I just couldn't turn them down. $100? What do they want with the billy goat? Well, Mama, they want him for a pet. A pet. Where are they going to keep him? Well, Mama, they're going to keep him in their apartment. In their apartment? Why, what about the smell? Well, Mama, the billy goat will just have to get used to it. But that really is not a joke, ladies and gentlemen. Let me tell you in all seriousness that this spring some friends of mine went out to California where they have some property. And I suggested that since they were going to be in the vicinity of Berkeley, it would be interesting for them to visit the campus and listen to the young intellectuals chatter. My friends did so. They found one of the cafes in which the progressive elements among the faculty and students congregate, but they stayed only a few minutes. They reported that they simply could not stand the stench of the vermin. It was an assemblage of beatniks, peaceniks, Marxists, and other degenerates in the habitat that they naturally create for themselves, squalid, dirty, many of them drug addicts. Such an assemblage as you can see on the campus of an up-to-date university these days, although Berkeley has the distinction of having a few more of them, or perhaps louder ones. The observer always finds it difficult to tell the difference between the male and the female of the species, and what complicates things is that many of the little animals evidently don't know it themselves. They're worse than savages. You may recall that early this year, a savage named Banda, whom you taxpayers support, is the chief of the Aborigines of Nyasaland, which is now called the Nation of Malawi, officially demanded the removal of what is called the Peace Corps. He said that the dirty white creatures running about the countryside, either furiously copulating with the blacks, or else squalled in a drunken stupor on the floors of the natives' mud huts, were simply demoralizing his savages. And he was doubtless right. You may be sure that the creatures of whom Banda complained came from our best colleges. What is happening to us? To the best of my knowledge, I have never been accused of optimism, not even by the local smear sheets here. But I will confess that even so recently as 12 years ago, I should have deemed it utterly impossible that such obvious degenerates would be tolerated in any institution that was trying to maintain the pretense that it was an educational institution. 12 years ago, I hoped for a resurgence of morality and patriotism. But I was prepared to go on watching shysters peddle their hokum and liberal intellectuals trying to live in a dream world built of empty words and, of course, traitors hiding behind the shrubbery of academic freedom. But I did not expect to see unabashed filth exulting in existence below the animal level. But now, as we all know, such vermin are not only tolerated, they are fostered. They are maintained on scholarships at the expense of American taxpayers. They are bred by a system of planned corruption, so that it is now impossible to tell how many of them were born that way, although we may be certain that many of them were, and how many of them might have developed into decent human beings if they had not been subjected to a degrading environment and debasing contacts in public schools. For make no mistake, these creatures are the product of the schools. Out in Berkeley, when these dregs rioted, and when they staged a sit-in, and hundreds of policemen had to perform the disgusting work of hauling the squealing and writhing animals out of university buildings, the faculty of that diploma mill, the faculty, mind you, voted more than 7-1 that nothing must be done to discipline the dear little cockroaches. After all, they had been led by members of the faculty who are communists. The one member of the university administration who was forced to resign was, of course, the man who was so reactionary as to think that there should be some perceptible difference between a public university and a garbage dump. Berkeley is not alone. At one of the institutions in Oklahoma, when the local police raided a nest of undergraduates, confiscated a very large store of narcotics, and hauled out of beds more than a dozen creatures who, being naked, were discovered to be of very oddly assorted sexes, the attitude of the faculty was shown by a yelp about police brutality and human rights. One thing that is producing these human drugs is, of course, the epidemic of addiction to narcotics among school children. There are three principal drugs: marijuana, which is brought in chiefly from Mexico; heroin, which is brought in from Red China and Red Cuba; and lysergic acid diethylamide, commonly known as LSD. Of the three, marijuana is the one most widely used by high school and college students, and it is frequently used as a starter. That is to say, once the victim is addicted to marijuana, he is supplied with marijuana to which the stronger drugs have been added, often without his knowledge. Of the three, lysergic acid diethylamide is by far the more dangerous, for it not only produces hallucinations and conduct such as that of the brother of little Bobby Baker, the great statesman in Washington. The brother was recently found naked in the top of a tree, peering into the windows of an apartment building. His explanation was that he'd had a dose of lysergic acid diethylamide. That drug also permanently damages the mind and produces irreparable harm. Now, Mr. Joseph J. Healy, chief of the narcotics division in Illinois, in his recent testimony before the U.S. Senate, stated that a principal obstacle to attempts to control the traffic in narcotics was the attitude of the colleges themselves. The educators, according to Mr. Healy, do not want the use of narcotics inhibited because, they say, students should be able to experiment and should be given freedom of choice of personal behavior. Of course, that's just the kind of gabble that we have been hearing from progressive and social-minded educators for decades. But if you were to talk to each of the educators who squawk about freedom of choice in the use of narcotics, including mind-destroying drugs, you would find that they do not believe in freedom of choice of personal behavior in other matters. But instead, they actually compel the hapless young men and women in their institutions to share rooms with Negroes, with Asiatics, with known sexual perverts, with known drug addicts. There must be no freedom of choice in such matters. We've got to have integration. That is what is being done by educators. What is more, the American people are paying them to do it. of what is happening to us. I have given you but one tiny example, one out of the probably 600 ways in which we are financing our own destruction. Everywhere you look, you will see, unless you close your eyes, the foulness and the moral rot of a society on the verge of total ruin. And yet it seems incredible, doesn't it? Here we are, comfortably seated in one of the best hotels left in the country, after an excellently prepared dinner, with intricate machinery at work to keep the temperature and humidity just what we wanted, with other intricate machinery lighting this hall, with a whole staff of attentive employees ministering to our comfort. It's hard to remind ourselves that the lights may go out 5 minutes from now and stay out if some Bolshevik agent 500 miles away has been ordered to pull a single switch. It's hard to remind ourselves that some of us may not reach our homes tonight without having been robbed, raped, or murdered as a result of the assiduous, persevering, and successful efforts of Earl Warren and his gang to guarantee criminals immunity from arrest and prosecution. It is painful to think that possibly tonight or tomorrow, some part of this city, conceivably including this hotel, may be reduced to a shambles of smoking ruins by howling mobs of hate-crazed savages. For what happened in Los Angeles, California, a few months ago was but a small pilot study for the actions that the communist conspiracy is planning in all large cities. And if you try to imagine what will happen to you and yours if the Bolsheviks officially take over the United States, your mind will refuse to contemplate it. We're so comfortable here. So comfortable here and now that all those things seem fantastic. When you try to think about them, you have the sense of unreality that I had a little while ago, when I sat in a luxurious apartment, 30 floors above the street, and conversed with a man who has made a very considerable fortune by sagacious investments. He has been quietly transferring his funds to several other parts of the world where civilization may last a little longer. And he intends to escape from the United States before the butchery starts. He wanted to know how much time we have left. And of course, I couldn't tell him. I could not even tell him that he was right in making arrangements to escape. For I really do not know whether or not we have already passed the point of no return. I only know that I hope very much that we have not. But it did seem unreal, almost dreamlike, to be discussing such things in the apparent security of that apartment, quiet, far above the orderly streets of the city, with the sun bright and hot in a cloudless sky outside, and the unseen machinery keeping us cool inside. But no one who knows anything of our present plight could possibly affirm that that man was taking a foolish precaution. What has happened to us? There are just two kinds of explanation. One is that what we are witnessing is a natural process, the result of biological and historical forces that we are powerless to control, and that therefore all that we can do is watch with melancholy resignation the terrible collapse of the world in which we are willing to live. Of course, those biological and historical forces have been variously identified by different writers, from Spengler to Bagby, but the terms that I have used fairly state the general import of 100 different theories. The other explanation is that we are the victims of some vast and evil conspiracy that has been working for a long time with almost infinite cunning and patience to undermine and destroy civilization, or at least the only civilization that matters to us, the one that we, the white men of the West, have created. Here again, there are diverse theories as to the nature and origin of the conspiracy, or of the central conspiracy, should there perchance be more than one at work. The one thing of which we can be absolutely certain, of course, is that there is an international communist conspiracy which operates under various guises, or at least in collaboration with various allies, such as the so-called Fabian socialists. The discussion begins when we try to decide just how strong and multiplex the communists are and whether they are really the central conspiracy or merely an arm of it. There is a wide variety of explanations, but I think we can reduce that variety to three principal identifications. The conspiracy that is destroying us is, we are told, a conspiracy of communists, or of Illuminati, or of Jews. Now, most of the authors who offer us one or another of these three identifications expound their views in a manner that is less than cogent. Most of them either overstate or oversimplify their case, and some of them, I am sorry to say, give the impression that they are no more intelligent than liberal intellectuals. Most of the writers on this subject are either so fascinated by their own discoveries or so anxious to convince the maximum number of readers that they imply that the conspiracy they identify is the root of all evil. That if it were abolished, mankind, all mankind, mind you, would enter instanter on a golden age of peace and domestic tranquility and happiness. If only by some miracle all the Bolsheviks or all the Illuminati or all the Jews were vaporized at dawn tomorrow, we should have nothing more to worry about. The trouble with that beatific vision, of course, is that every educated man knows it just can't be so. Civilization, in the wider sense, is a very recent thing on this earth, but recorded history, the history of our civilization and of others that came earlier, goes back a little more than 5,000 years. And history is a record of wars, massacres, revolutions, famines, plagues, terror, and death. To be sure, civilization at its worst is far less horrible than the primeval savagery that preceded it. But history is a record of blood and tears, often shed in vain, but sometimes adding a little to that necessarily slow and painful ascent from the step pyramids of the first dynasties of socialistic Egypt to the rational human freedom envisaged by the American Constitution. But it is a history of blood and tears, and no intellectually honest man can promise all mankind any future within the next 1,000 years other than blood and tears. The most that we can help is that we, the men of the West, can regain for ourselves that comparative state of security and less suffering that we enjoyed around the turn of the century when we used the technological power that we alone have created to dominate the world. The comparative tranquility that a large part, not all, of our population enjoyed in the brief decades before we started to commit suicide. There is also a chronological difficulty. If we identify the conspirators as communists, we presumably trace the conspiracy back to that fetid degenerate Karl Marx, or at least to his time, say 120 or 130 years ago. That leaves a lot of history unexplained. If we take the alternative, the Illuminati, we can go back a little farther. The famous order of Illuminati was founded by another degenerate, Adam Weishaupt, in 1776. And that secret conspiracy undoubtedly had something, probably a very great deal, to do with the orgy of bestiality that is commonly called the French Revolution. But that was very late in history. We can go back by assuming that there were the White House's conspiracy was a continuation of earlier ones, to the earliest conspiracy of that kind of which we have an historical record, founded in the Near East in the 9th century after Christ. So we stop in the 9th century A.D., comparatively recent times. If we pick the Jews as the conspiratorial nucleus, we can do better chronologically. But satisfactory historical evidence takes us back only to the 5th century before Christ, although we can, with some probability, go back another century. But there we must stop, so far as strictly historical evidence is concerned. We have gone back, in other words, only half the span of recorded history. So what are you going to do with the other half? How are you going to explain, for example, the breakdown of Egyptian civilization at the end of the 6th dynasty in the 23rd century B.C.? And are you going to make the Jews so ubiquitous that they will be responsible for the convulsions in the long history of China, or for the fall of the Mayan culture in Central America? A continuous conspiracy from the beginning of recorded time certainly gets us into difficulties, doesn't it? Now, this difficulty should not make us lose sight of our one certainty, that there is an international conspiracy that affected the conquest of Russia in 1918 and has ever since been moving steadily toward conquest of the whole world, now within striking distance of its goal. And it now very confidently expects us to fall into its hands within the next few years like a ripe fruit, or should I say, a rotten fruit. The professional brainwashers in our colleges have tried to cover up that fact by inventing a phrase, the conspiratorial theory of history. A phrase which, of course, must be uttered with a quick giggle to prevent the audience from thinking about it. When so uttered, the phrase sticks so well that many young men who have risen above liberal superstitions since they came out of college still cling to that one. And as soon as you speak to them of international communism and its obvious subversion of our country, they immediately say, by an automatic reflex, conspiratorial theory of history, and then they go, ha-ha, and sometimes, hee-haw. That is simply to ignore the indisputable fact that second only to foreign wars and invasions, political conspiracies are the principal causes of historical mutations. One could spend hours merely reciting the names of famous political conspiracies that have changed the course of history. A common type is what is often called the palace conspiracy, which normally results in the assassination of a despot or other important political figure. Typical examples are the assassination of the false Smerdis in Persia in the 6th century B.C. by the conspirators who placed Darius the Great on the throne. The assassination of Julius Caesar at the end of the Roman Republic. The assassinations of Caligula and many other emperors during the Roman Empire. The conspiracy that made Catherine the Great the ruler of Russia. And if you wish, the conspiracy that carried out the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. There is another type of conspiracy, the revolutionary conspiracy, which necessarily involves a much larger number of persons, normally a very large number of actual conspirators. Of such conspiracies, the history of the Greek states provide many examples. Everyone knows of the conspiracy headed by Catiline to burn and pillage Rome and enjoy a general massacre. Most people have heard of the great Jewish conspiracy of 117 to 118 A.D., which extended across almost the whole of northern Africa and forced the imperial Roman Empire to recall its legions from farther Mesopotamia, almost shook the empire to its foundations. In such conspiracies, large numbers must necessarily participate. And while the conspirators very naturally try to keep their conspiracy secret and hidden until the moment they strike, they themselves know specifically what they plan to do. Catiline's followers, and there were thousands of them, must have known when they were recruited that their purpose was to burn and pillage and kill, although naturally they did not know all the details of their leader's plans. Now you could identify a third type of conspiracy, which, as I said a moment ago, has no historical example, no certain one at least, before the 9th century A.D. That is the conspiracy that is based on mass deception. It is a secret society with grades of initiation and under the direction of a small inner circle whose members alone know its true purpose. The founder of the Bottini, for example, in the 9th century, had a sovereign contempt for the mass of his followers. He called them jackasses. His trusted emissaries were instructed to enlist recruits by professing whatever religious doctrine or national feeling was most likely to appeal to the jackasses in their territory. They, for example, in one place or another, professed every variety of Muslim cult, many non-Muslim cults, and philosophical atheism. They appealed to the anti-Arab sentiments of the Persians and to the anti-Persian sentiments of the Arabs. It was thus possible to set in motion and direct a vast multitude of men of the most diverse beliefs and nationalities, making them all work for an ultimate purpose that was known only to a little inner circle. And the conspiracy was highly successful. There is undoubtedly a conspiracy of some kind, and a powerful one. We know that there is the Bolshevik conspiracy at work. But our difficulty is that to explain even what is happening today, we need something more than a conspiracy, however cunning and subtle you may suppose it to be, to explain our decline. So let us look for a moment at biology. We all know that this planet has had upon it many more species of life that are now extinct than it has species that survive. We all call to mind some of those species. The dinosaurs once were the mightiest living beings, and for a whole geologic age they ruled the world. But they had a brain the size of a cherry, and they have long been extinct. The dodos, pigeons as big as swans, flourished for millennia on the islands of Mauritius and Reunion, but life was too easy for them. Eventually, there arrived settlers from Europe, bringing with them hogs and rats. The last dodo perished sometime in the 17th century. We are now witnessing a most impressive biological spectacle and lesson. In Africa, the mountain gorilla is rapidly becoming extinct, and some observers believe that there are less than 1,000 of them still alive. They are becoming extinct not because they are hunted by man or by other animals, nor yet because their food supply is vanishing, but simply because the species is losing its vital instincts, its will to live and perpetuate itself. As for pre-human anthropoids, we know that many of them became extinct. The Australopithecus and similar species have certainly vanished. The Sinanthropus is extinct. And, for all practical purposes, so are the Neanderthals. Although, if you walk over a college campus or through a big city these days, you have your doubts. There is no biological reason, you know, why we, the white men of the West, who were the undisputed masters of the whole world a few years ago, may not also become extinct in one way or another. In fact, our extinction is already being discussed in many parts of the world. As you know, Mao Zedong has promised to abolish white men. Mao is the Bolshevik satrap to whom the State Department in Washington delivered China, and whom that same nest keeps in power by protecting him from invasion by the civilized Chinese on Formosa. In India, Krishna Menon has often and rapidly proclaimed his yearning to see white men exterminated and says that the keystone of his policy is to hasten that glorious day. As you know, American farmers were out this afternoon in their fields working to raise food to keep Krishna Menon and his gang in power in India. But oddly enough, some of the loudest yelps come from persons who look white. Up in Canada, there is a creature called Brock Chisel, who, with the help of Alger Hiss, founded the World Health Organization that is agitating for mental health. Now, Chisel's big brain just fizzes night and day with mental health. And one of his major worries is how to prevent white men and women from having children so that we can stamp out the white race and have one world. We have in this country an oversized brain named Roderick Seidenberg that has written two books to suggest that it will be easy, by drugs, surgery, and selective breeding, to destroy the human mind completely and make the working population, which of course means us, unconscious. Really unconscious, so that we will work as do ants and termites by reflex action and not even know that we exist. And then, of course, there is the great civil rights movement, which naturally draws its real inspiration from the great and highly successful civil rights movement in Haiti early in the 19th century. In Haiti, as you know, the blacks, instigated and supplied with arms from England and France, systematically butchered all white men, butchered all white children, and eventually butchered all white women, after keeping many of them shut up for a time in pens, for uses which some of you may be able to imagine. That has been the real goal of the civil rights agitators from the first, although many people, deceived by the unctuous cant of ministers, professors, and other agitators, refused to believe it until the cries of kill, Whitey, kill were heard in our riot-torn cities, and the doctrine of extermination was openly preached hour after hour and day after day from powerful radio stations in Cuba. It should be understood that I am not blaming the Negroes in America for the race war that is almost upon us, that will very soon reach the point of no return. The Negroes, from the time of that sinister agitation that began in the early part of this century, have been incited and driven by whites. And a great many intelligent Negroes have striven desperately to avert the catastrophe. I need only mention the late Manning Johnson, who wrote Color, Communism, and Common Sense, and was probably killed for his effort. And that courageous lady, Julia Brown, whom I'm happy to see with us tonight, and whose book I testify has just come from the press, for a quite different approach. It is odd that many Negroes perceived or sensed the inevitable result of the agitation long before it was glimpsed by white people. Thanks to our controlled press, very few people know that there are now active in the United States at least four organizations of Negroes who are petitioning the United States Senate to pass what is known as the Langer Bill, which provides for assistance to Negroes who desire to return to Africa. There are, I say, at least four such organizations. One is the Peace Movement of Ethiopia, with headquarters in Chicago, whose purpose, as stated on its letterhead, is, quote, to return people of African descent to their motherland, Africa. Others are the African Universal Church, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and the Universal African Nationalist Movement. Now, I do not know the leaders of these organizations, and so I cannot express an opinion about them. But they must represent a considerable segment of the colored population, for in support of the original Langer Bill, they were able to present to the Senate a petition signed by more than 2 million American Negroes who desired repatriation, which they describe, quite properly in historical terms, as the Abraham Lincoln Plan. 2 million is a significant number, isn't it? And even more significant is the fact that the very existence of this movement has been so sedulously concealed by our kept press. If we intend to survive ourselves and to have a posterity, we shall have to toughen ourselves intellectually by facing some very unpleasant facts. I know they are unpleasant, and that it would be ever so much nicer if we could pretend that those facts just didn't exist. But I'm going to mention a few of them. They're independent of the international communist conspiracy, in the sense that they would represent for us a terrible danger and deadly menace if, by some divine miracle, every Bolshevik conspirator in the world were vaporized at dawn tomorrow. Everyone has heard of the so-called population explosion. But everyone seems afraid to think about it. The number of human beings, anatomically human at least, is undoubtedly increasing at an appalling rate. The United States is already overpopulated for optimum life, although no critical reduction in our standard of living would be necessary for the better part of a century if our masters permitted us to remain an independent nation. But our increase is nothing compared to the terrible multiplication of the populations of Asia and Africa, caused chiefly by our export to those regions of our medical knowledge, medicines, food, and money. Although we, the world's white and civilized minority, and we are a small minority, we may be able to stave off a crisis for a few decades by working harder and ever harder to support our betters and speed up the rate at which they are breeding, it is perfectly obvious that we, unless we do something unthinkable, must soon be drowned in the flood that we, like the sorcerer's apprentice, started but do not know how to stop. At the present rate, the globe, sometime between 2000 and 2005 AD, that is to say within 40 years, will be infested by 5 billion anatomically human creatures, the maximum number for which food can be supplied by even the most intensive cultivation. And then, just to keep the globe inhabitable at that bare subsistence level, then it will be necessary to kill every year more people than now live in the United States. Kill them with atomic bombs or clubs as may be most convenient. That is the statistically certain future. Some people talk about averting the crisis by preaching methods of birth control, which, if there were no other objection to them, would be about as effective as an effort to bail out the sinking Titanic with a bucket. Other people indulge in pipe dreams about some scientific miracle that will double the known means of producing food and so postpone the crisis for all of 20 years. No one seems willing to stop a moment and think about what is wrong with the statistics. What is wrong, not arithmetically, but humanly wrong? This world is not going to have a population of 5 billion by 2005 AD. It's not going to have that population at any time in the future. Not ever. The one thing that is certain, absolutely certain, is that the population of the world is going to be drastically reduced before the year 2000. The reduction could come through natural causes. There are at least 5 ways, all scientifically possible, in which the world could be partly depopulated in short order by strictly natural forces beyond our control. But if nature does not act, man will. When things became a bit crowded in East Asia, for example, the Huns, and at a later time the Mongols, swept a wide swath through the world as locusts sweep through a wheat field. And wherever they felt the inspiration, they were every bit as efficient as any quantity of hydrogen bombs you could care to imagine. In the natural course of human events, we shall see in the near future wars of extermination on a scale and of an intensity that your mind at present will refuse to contemplate. The only question will be what people will be among the exterminated. If we intend to survive, we shall have to use, and use rationally and willingly, all our great technological genius and all the truly scientific knowledge about the nature of the world that we have been able to attain. I am speaking now about scientific knowledge, not the pseudo-scientific hogwash that is generally used in public schools and colleges to pervert the minds of the young. I shall mention one area that is fundamental to any understanding of human problems, the science of genetics. That, by the way, is the newest of all the scientific disciplines, and this year we should be observing the centennial of its foundation,
by an obscure, humble, and too modest Augustinian monk, Father Johann Gregor Mendel. Despite the restraints placed on scientific investigation by liberal intellectuals and the like, and despite the awesome complexity of genetic factors in so complicated a creature as man, it is now virtually certain that all of the physiological structure of human beings, including such details as color of eyes, acuity of vision, stature, susceptibility to specific diseases, and formation of the brain, are genetically determined beyond possibility of modification or alteration, except by physical injury or chemical damage. It is far more difficult to investigate intellectual and moral capacities, but all of the evidence thus far available indicates that intelligence and probably moral instincts are as completely and unalterably determined by genetic inheritance as physical traits. Many persons find the conclusions thus suggested unpleasant, just as all of us, I am sure, would be much happier if the earth were the immobile center of the universe and the heavens revolved about it. But although vast areas in the new science remain unexplored, the principles of heredity have been determined with a fairly high degree of scientific probability, and they are furthermore in accord with what common sense has always told us, and also with that rational perception of our place in the universe that underlies religion. We can blind children, but we cannot give them sight. We can stunt and debauch their minds in progressive schools, but we cannot give them intelligence they did not inherit at birth. It is likely that we can make criminals of them by putting them, like the somewhat improbable Oliver Twist, in Fagin's gang or its equivalent, but we cannot induce a moral sense in one who was born without it. We have always known that it is easy for man to destroy what he can never create. All men are created unequal, and there is nothing we can do about that. That is the law of life, and we had better recognize it. The Bolsheviks secretly understand and use the scientific knowledge they would conceal from us in the schools. Why do you suppose that most states now have legislation to subsidize and accelerate the breeding of bastards, of whom at least 95% are the offspring of the very dregs of the population, the shiftless, the irresponsible, the stupid, the degenerate? Why is so large a part of your income stolen by the federal government and devoted to the stimulation in every conceivable way of the hideous fecundity of the unfit, the criminal, and the imbecile elements in our already excessive population? That is not merely to produce a voting majority of parasites, to keep gangs in power by majority rule. Figure it out genetically. There is another unpleasant fact, painful to the tender-minded, that you could deduce from the laws of heredity. It is also conclusively established by direct observation. A fact so obvious that rational men have always known it, and no one doubted it until Bolsheviks and liberals gained control of our schools and began to teach our children as impudent a falsehood as has ever been perpetuated. That is the natural and unalterable dissimilarity and therefore inequality of races. The observed differences, physical, mental, and instinctive, are in fact so great that the proponents of the doctrine of biological evolution have found it simply impossible to trace the five primary races back to a single human type. To account for the biological differences in evolutionary terms, it is necessary to assume the existence of five different species of pre-human anthropoids. To conclude, in other words, that racial differences antedate humanity and the earliest kind of life that can be called human. For the reasons why the observed differences are too great to permit the hypothesis of a single human ancestral type, I refer you to Professor Carlton S. Coon's The Origin of Races, first published in 1962. I have mentioned some of these biological realities of the world in which we live. They are doubtless regrettable, but they are unalterable. If you find them intolerable and unthinkable, the only thing that I can suggest is that you try to flag down a flying saucer and take passage for some other solar system. The one thing that we must not do is to follow the standard procedure of liberals. Imagine a nice dream world in which the laws of nature do not operate. And then, like children playing games in their nursery, pretend that we are living in it. Such infantilism is simply suicidal. At the risk of shocking you further, I shall point out that if we intend to survive, we shall have to do something to bring do-gooding under control. We now regard it, I know, as a kind of amiable weakness, something like alcoholism, and even take pride in some of its manifestations. When a puckish reporter in New York several years ago experimented by solemnly telling people with an unwinking stare that he was collecting money to buy clothes for Cinderella, he obtained, as I remember, about $140 in 2 hours. I suspect that most of us who saw his whimsical report felt a kind of satisfaction in it as a proof of our national generosity. We may not be very bright, but we sure got hearts of gold. But now those givers may have been foolish, but at least they were exercising the Christian virtue of charity, which, remember, is to give voluntarily of our own money and effort. The do-gooder is another species. He claims he wants to do good with other people's money, and often at the expense of other people's lives. Have you ever stopped to consider the enormous havoc and ruin that has been wrought in this world by earnest do-gooders? Often under stimulus from experts, to be sure, but earnest nevertheless. I know that Woodrow Wilson was a pliant tool in the hands of those who selected him and boosted him into the presidency, especially Colonel House and Jakob Schiff. But he is reported to have exclaimed before his death, "God forgive me, I have unwittingly ruined my country." If he felt that remorse, he cannot have been entirely cynical. He probably did have some of the characteristic hallucinations of do-gooders. He may actually have believed that there could be such a thing as a war to end wars, thus make the world safe for democracy. If so, those figments of his imagination sent 115,000 of our best men to a useless death and inflicted on another 200,000 painful wounds, maiming many of them for life. Is that a proper price to ask a nation to pay just because some muzzy-headed dreamer feels an itch to save the world at our expense? Our history provides us with a far more terrible example in a strange breed that flourished other places, and especially here in New England a little more than a century ago. It was another grim appearance in history of the old illusions of Gnosticism. Whence came the Transcendentalists? Whence came the abolitionists? Whence came the conspiracy of the secret six, as they call themselves, who used as their instrument that distinguished horse thief and homicidal maniac, John Brown, whom liberals so much admire for his ferocity. We all know how much the secret six and their kind had to do with forcing on the South a desperate war for independence that ended so tragically for the South and eventually for the whole nation just a century ago. We all know the history of that bloody and terrible war, of the many battles that left whole countrysides drenched with the best blood of our race, of the almost unbelievable valor and courage shown on both sides. Now, I fully understand that throughout history, and especially perhaps in the United States, slavery has been a baneful and pernicious institution, most baneful indeed in its effect on the owners. I do have a deep sympathy and compassion for the Negroes. There were 4 million of them at that time in our land. They have since been so oppressed, you know, that there is a larger number. But I wonder whether anyone can read the history of that vast slaughter and ruin that has indelibly stained the pages of our history without asking himself whether that was not too great a price to pay. Bismarck was not a humanitarian and did not pretend to be one. But he once said, as a strictly practical matter, that a German colony in the South Seas was not worth the bones of one Prussian grenadier. And let our compassion for the slaves and our liking for their race be as great as you will, I can only marvel if any man can find it in his heart to say that their emancipation was worth the lives of just one company of men in any one of the regiments from Virginia or Minnesota that met at Shiloh, Chickamauga, or Gettysburg. No race could afford much do-gooding on that scale. There is another fact of life that everyone knows, but many people try to ignore, and that is the prevalence of innate evil in the human species, including, I am sorry to say, all races. If you are a Christian, you have divine authority for the perception of how terribly extensive and powerful in this world is the domain of evil, pure evil. If you are not, you must follow some doctrine of biological evolution, and you will find that the real mystery is how it happened that men, any man, became thoughtful and kind. Civilization is only a little more than 5,000 years, a mere moment in biological time. It is perfectly obvious that the genetic stock of every race must contain innumerable genes that persist from primeval savagery, and that even the most cultivated and refined society must produce beings whose lust for evil is doubtless stronger than any man's desire for good. Have you ever stopped to think what would happen in any city if the police were really as ineffectual as Earl Warren is trying to make them? Have you ever considered the biological source of the many crimes that are committed, even in the best policed societies, for no other motive than the pleasure, the sheer pleasure of committing them? The joys of brutality, the joys of evil for its own sake. There are many such crimes that no one remembers. The newspapers mention them briefly, if at all, in veiled language. And the reader forgets before the next morning what should be a sobering lesson that would make him think. A few crimes attain a kind of adventitious notoriety. One thinks of Loeb and Leopold in Chicago, of Harman in Germany, Vache in France, the Princess Belgioso in Italy, and a few others. Some of you may remember the well-known cannibal of Washington, D.C., Albert Fish. He was fond of children, so fond of them that he kidnapped and ate about 15 of them, after first mutilating and torturing them in various ways. He was captured in 1935, and since Earl Warren was not on the Supreme Court at that time, he was executed. Creatures like that are produced in much larger numbers than you would like to believe. Biologically, you can explain them as examples of either atavism or degeneration, but you dare not ignore them, if you are going to understand the nature of the world in which you live. For if you do not understand Gilles de Rais, the Marquis de Sade, Loeb and Leopold, Harman, Fish and their kind, you cannot understand Bolsheviks. Let me conclude with one further comment on what I have tried to say. When the Bolsheviks, jackals, in the press and radio snarl at us, they usually hiss, racist and white supremacist. Let me make it clear, therefore, that I am not arguing for the superiority of the white race. I am asking a question, a biological question. Have we, the men of the West, who are a small minority among the world's inhabitants, who are the sole creators of a civilization whose technology gives us absolute mastery of the world if we want it, we whose Christian civilization, for all its defects, is in comparison with others as superior morally as it is technologically, have we lost the will to live? That is a question that any observer must ask when he sees the incredible spectacle of a great nation taxing itself to nourish cannibals, draining away its economic blood to arm Bolsheviks, tolerating in its own midst the systematic breeding with its own money of degeneracy and crime. Have our minds become so befuddled by the hypocritical jabbering of unhuman invaders and the babbling of our own fools that we have lost even the instinct of self-preservation? If indeed we have, then by the irrevocable law of nature, we have become like the dinosaurs, the dodos, and the mountain gorillas, biologically obsolete, and the world will soon know us no more.